Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, with all the discussion about a graduated income tax for Illinois, you might be surprised to learn the state had one for a short time. We'll explain how it happened and why it went away. We'll delve into some of the legislation proposed to lessen requirements on teachers in Illinois, and we'll also take a look at farm bankruptcies. Baseball season is upon us. This year marks the 100th anniversary of what's known as the Black Sox scandal. It's been written about, there was a movie, but some new details have emerged that changed the story.
Like many areas of history, there's a lot of compelling aspects, and the truth is just as dramatic as some of the fictional elements that we've all grown up believing.
We'll talk with a baseball researcher. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to another edition of Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, as another baseball season gets underway, we'll look back 100 years to the 1919 Black Sox scandal, players throwing the World Series. It's a well-known story, but there's some new research into what happened, and we'll talk with one of those who's uncovered more details. Also, we'll take a look at farm bankruptcy amid a struggling ag economy. That and more on the way. First up, there is a lot of debate going on over a plan to move Illinois to a graduated income tax system. It would have those who earn above certain amounts pay higher rates. But what many people don't know is that Illinois once had a graduated tax for a brief period. For Illinois Issues this week, I talked with columnist Charlie Wheeler, who tells the story of how it happened and why it went away. Charlie, we're going back to the early 1930s here. The governor was Lewis Emerson. He was a Mount Vernon Republican. What led to his decision to seek a graduated income tax?
Well, I think you have to look at what was happening on the national level, or internationally, I guess, at that time. That was right after the crash in the 20s. The Great Depression was underway, and the economic climate in Illinois was horrendous. There'd also been, well, at that time, the state derived most of its revenues from a property tax on real estate, land and buildings, and on personal, tangible property that people owned. So, for example, in the case of a family, it would be the automobile, if they had one. It would be the clothes. It would be the food in the pantry. It would be the furniture. For a business, it would be its inventory, it would be whatever vehicles it might have, it would be the office equipment, the file cabinets, the tables, the typewriters, all of that stuff. And it was supposed to be assessed uniformly, and as a matter of fact, the property tax actually predated Illinois. The territorial legislature of Illinois imposed a property tax. And what happened, kind of coincidentally, there'd been a massive reassessment of all property in Cook County, and the assessment had delayed property tax bills going out for a couple of years. And so, as the governor noted when he proposed this tax to a joint session of the legislature in late 1931, very few people set aside reserves to cover the taxes, and now suddenly we have the Depression, and they don't have the resources. So the money wasn't coming in. He had appointed a commission, one of the several commissions he appointed, to study the situation. They came back with a recommendation. They recommended that there be an income tax. Quoting here from the report, "The fairest distribution of governmental burden yet devised has been accomplished by the federal income tax, which had been in place at that point for a few years. The production of revenues at the expense of those best able to bear the burden." And so that was his committee's recommendation. It proposed this graduated income tax, the theory being that an income tax would measure the wealth of someone that was not embodied in tangible things like land, automobiles, furniture, but kind of what was referred to in one reference as being kind of the hidden wealth that we don't know about. But the income tax would cover it. And we had a scramble because not only did we have the ordinary expenses of state government, but there were many efforts to provide relief for people who were suffering under the Depression.
Charlie, it's hard to imagine this being at a time when the Great Depression is happening. that state politicians would move to do something like implement an income tax.
Well, I think part of it was, as I said, the assumption was that if you're out of a job and you're going to lose your home, you have no income in the first place. On the other hand, with a property tax, you're out of a job until you lose your home. You're responsible to pay the taxes on it. The idea being that people who were fortunate enough to still be working, still having an income, would be the ones who would bear the burden of this tax. Plus, people who had assets that weren't taxed under the property tax would be contributing, in the words of the report, they'd be doing their share of the burden.
So the need is shown, but he still has to sell this, not only to the public, but to lawmakers as well.
Interestingly enough, his commission that recommended this was made up of people who were, I guess, the movers and shakers of the time, including business interests, and they saw this as a better deal for them, I think because, as I said earlier, if a business is not making a profit and has no income, they'd have no liability. But all their manufacturing equipment, their real estate, that would still be subject to the property tax. And I should point out that the proceeds from this new graduated income tax were all going to be going to pay for local school costs, with the idea being that then the property taxes that supported schools could be abated somewhat. It was seen also as property tax relief. And some of the opposition during the legislative session that finally enacted that was along the lines of, look, we have to do something to relieve property taxes right away. We don't have time to mess around with a brand new type of tax. Let's do something to reduce the impact of property taxes, particularly on homeowners who have no means to pay the property taxes and are in danger of losing their homes.
Well, a few months after it gets through, it winds up going to courts, and eventually it's thrown out because saying that it is unconstitutional. And so what happens after that?
Well, Governor Emerson signed the bill on February 22nd of 1932. In October 22nd of 1932, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled without dissent that it was unconstitutional. And they based their ruling on the 1870 Constitution, which said the legislature could impose taxes. It can provide revenue as may be needed by levying a tax by valuation, so that every person and corporation shall pay a tax in proportion to the value of his, her, or its property. And the court said, well, income is property, and it requires, the Constitution says property has to be taxed on a per value, ad valorem basis, in proportion to the value of the property. So you can't have a law that applies different tax rates to different levels of income. That's just totally unconstitutional. In November of 1932, it was on the national level pretty much a Democratic landslide. We elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt to be the president. In Illinois, Henry Horner was elected governor. And Governor Horner, and with sizable Democratic majorities in the legislature, and Horner proposed what we call today the sales tax, replacing the property tax, the statewide property tax. I believe the last levy of a statewide property tax was in 1932, and Horner rescinded it. So the state has not received a penny of property taxes for 80-some years.
So, Charlie, we had a graduated income tax for a very brief period in law. That gets overturned, again, in the early 1930s. We go about 37 more years till we finally get an income tax in the state of Illinois, and that was a flat tax, and which is what we still have today, a flat tax system. Why did it take so long?
Well, I think one of the reasons it took so long was that the state really wasn't in dire financial straits for much of that time. As we got closer to in the 60s, moving through the 60s, there were several sessions, including a couple of special sessions, in which the legislature had to increase the sales tax rate because the state was having problems meeting its obligations, particularly in the area of welfare. programs that were in place to help people who were down on their luck were costing more than what the people who did the budgeting had anticipated and what the revenues were sustaining. And there was also a desire to pump more money into local schools to help reduce property taxes, which I guess is 50 years later, we still have that ambition. And so during the campaign, the 1968 campaign, the Republican candidate, the Cook County Board President Richard Ogilvie, and the Democratic incumbent Sam Shapiro, who had been elected lieutenant governor in 64 with Otto Kerner as the governor. Kerner had been named to the federal bench as a judge, and Shapiro succeeded him. They really didn't make a big issue of the state's revenue condition as they were running. From what I read and from talking to people who were, there was kind of a general consensus among the Ogilvie camp and the Shapiro partisans, whichever guy won was going to have to bite the bullet and probably propose an income tax. So Ogilvie wins, and as a matter of fact, on April 1st of 1969, in an address to the General Assembly, he lays out the reasons why he thinks we need an income tax. And there was still doubt about whether or not you could actually do an income tax. It was pretty clear you could not do one with a graduated rate. That legislation passed, was signed into law, immediately challenged, and within a matter of weeks, the Supreme Court ruled that it was valid. It did not violate the Constitution. And then maybe another couple weeks later, they came out with an opinion that said, in essence, income is not property. It happened in the run-up to the 6th Illinois Constitutional Convention, which first met in December of 1969, and then met throughout the first 9 months of 1970, finally agreeing to a revenue article that basically ratified what the Income Tax Act provided. In other words, that we could have an income tax, but it had to be at a flat rate, or as the Constitution, at a non-graduated rate. Now, there was some debate, some interest in the Constitution, in the Revenue Committee, and also on the floor of allowing a graduated income tax or freezing the level for personal income. Despite interest in it, it was never incorporated into the final document, which the voters then ratified in late 1970, and that's the Constitution that we have today.
You can read Charlie Wheeler's column on Illinois' history with a graduated income tax. We have a link available at our website, statewideshow.com. An increasing number of farmers filed for bankruptcy in many states in 2018, raising alarm over the apparent downturn in the farm economy. But economists say if you go by all of the numbers, the ag sector at large is getting by, as Grant Gerlach tells us more.
A semi-trailer fills to the brim with corn on Ben Steffens' farm near Humboldt in southeast Nebraska.
I think I'll tip this auger up on this, and then I'll pull my truck up alongside.
This harsh winter has a silver lining. Steffen can earn extra money on his corn because he can deliver, while others are stuck on snow-packed roads.
We're in a situation where we're counting nickels and pennies on every transaction, and we're trying to capture every penny we can.
Over the last few years, farm income has taken a long, hard fall, dropping 50% since 2013.
When you've spent 5 years of your life pouring your energy into a business and you're worse off today than 5 years ago, it feels like a crisis.
That word, crisis, evokes memories of the 1980s when farms went out of business by the score. The fear now is that the industry is headed in the same direction. So let's look at one indicator of financial calamity, bankruptcy. Nearly 500 farms filed for Chapter 12 bankruptcy nationwide in 2018. Chapter 12 is a way for farmers and fishermen to settle debts without selling off the whole business. But the economists I talked to say that's not a crisis.
Just to clarify, I mean, there are a lot of check engine lights on with the dash. The metrics that we all talked about are trending the wrong way.
That's David Widmar, an economist with the website Agricultural Economic Insights. Several states have seen bankruptcy numbers rise a few years in a row now, like Wisconsin, Kansas, and Nebraska.
That said, there were still farms filing bankruptcies in 2011, 12, and 13 when net farm income was at its highest.
So the current bankruptcy rate is normal, but there are other lights on the dashboard to check out. Income is the big one. Widmar says trade disputes have slashed exports of crops like soybeans. And Nathan Kaufman of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City says as grain piles up, prices are holding at or below the break-even mark.
Whatever may or may not happen with trade policy, I think those supplies are likely to continue to weigh on commodity prices for the foreseeable future.
Kaufman is watching to see if that ripples through broader financial indicators like loan repayment rates and land values. But he says the story with those statistics is the same as the rest of the farm economy. Gradually worse, but not bad by historical standards.
You know, this may still persist for a little while, but it certainly has not gotten to the point where I think that we would call it the kind of crisis that we saw playing out in the 1980s.
The vast majority of farms are managing to work through this downturn by spending savings, borrowing against land, and cutting costs. On paper, it looks manageable. In person, it's scary. Normally, Stefan, the farmer in Nebraska, always keeps a year's worth of hay on hand to feed his dairy herd, but he didn't fill that reserve last year.
So we did not have to lay out money to buy hay, but that bill is coming and it's staring at us. That's happened across agriculture. We're eating up our equity.
For Stefan, it feels like walking a financial tightrope.
We will try to manage our way through this, but every spending decision is scrutinized now. And farming can be a fun enterprise if you don't mind losing sleep and borrowing a lot of money.
Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Coming up, we'll continue our look at farm bankruptcy. A special bankruptcy code helps family farms restructure debt so they can return to producing food or commodity crops. But there is a catch. We'll have that story next. We're back on Statewide. On the way, we've been hearing about some changing requirements to become a teacher. We'll have a look at some of the proposals. And new information about the 1919 Chicago Black Sox scandal. That's just some of what we have coming up on Statewide. Now we continue our look at farm bankruptcy. There's a special bankruptcy code for U.S. family farms. It's called Chapter 12, allowing them to restructure their debt. Esther Honig reports that today's farmers sometimes have to go so far into the red there is no relief.
This lobby at an animal sanctuary in northern Colorado is filled with wood shavings, wire cages, and about a dozen chickens. Chrissy DiNardo works here and describes what she saw in January when volunteers rescued 610 birds from a farm owned by a local meat company.
So some of the birds we brought in, they have wounds on their bodies and they were literally being eaten alive.
The chicken farm had gone bankrupt. Owner Chad Anderson told Harvest Public Media that within a day, the government froze the company's assets, even though they had 70,000 chickens and just 3 days worth of feed.
They started reaching out to wildlife centers and zoos to feed the chickens to their carnivores because they didn't even have the means to send the chickens to slaughterhouses.
Fortunately, financially troubled farms can often find help because there's a bankruptcy code specifically for them. Chapter 12. It was created during the 1980s farming crisis and helps family farms restructure debt and stay in business. But there's a catch, one that partly tripped up the chicken farm. An operation can't have more than about $4 million of debt. In downtown Denver, lawyer Guy Humphreys specializes in Chapter 12. He can even see the federal court from his office on the 14th floor.
Yeah, no, it's a short walk and it's easier for clients and that sort of thing.
Chapter 12 is friendlier than other bankruptcies. Payments are adjusted to meet a farmer's cash flow, and certain types of debt can even be forgiven. But the key really is meeting that $4 million cap. And that can be hard to do at a time when farmers have near-record debt. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it's about $410 billion. And while most family farms still qualify for Chapter 12, the share of those who have too much debt has slowly grown over the last decade.
And I've had several farm cases in the past 2 years that where their debts were too high.
Most of that debt is due to high cost of land and machinery. A new combine, for instance, will set a farmer back about $400,000. John Newton is an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation and says Chapter 12 needs an update.
You know, raising the debt limit really needs to reflect how modern agriculture is, how it's changed so much in the last 20 to 30 years.
To solve the problem, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa wants to increase the debt limit from $4 million to $10 million. Of course, many Americans may ask, why should big family farms be treated any differently than big business? For starters, says Newton, 98% of U.S. farms are run by families, not corporations. Plus,
agriculture is the only sector of the U.S. economy where Mother Nature is your business partner.
There's a lot of uncertainty in American agriculture due to falling commodity prices and trade disputes with countries like China. But if the ag industry were to tank, raising the debt limit on Chapter 12 could keep more family farms from going under. Over half the chickens on the bankrupt farm were slaughtered and sold. The remaining 30,000 had to be donated or rescued, according to the company. Peter McCoskey volunteered with the Animal Sanctuary to help find new homes for some of them.
When we're talking about animal agriculture, bankruptcy presents this really unique problem because we're not talking about cases of strawberries or cucumbers.
And it's farmers who own chickens or run dairies who are especially vulnerable to bankruptcy because thin profit margins force them to take on more debt. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Stateville Calling is a documentary about the lack of parole in Illinois and the organizers who are trying to change that. Film screenings have been taking place across the state. Our reporter Dana Vollmer spoke with the producer, Yana Kunichoff, about why this subject is important now.
I think that given the Trump presidency in the last couple of years, I think we're really interested in thinking about how change is made at the local level or the state level. And we felt that Illinois was a really interesting example of some of the work that a committed group of activists were able to do here around a criminal justice issue that seemed particularly intractable, which was getting rid of the death penalty. And Bill Ryan, who's a central character in our documentary, was a really big part of that. So I think taking some of those lessons and thinking about how they might apply to the system today was really interesting for us.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can contextualize that a little bit more just for people who are maybe unfamiliar with the fact that we once had a parole system that ended in the 70s. We also put a moratorium on the death sentence. How did we get to this point where you're not allowed to be sentenced to death, however you can spend your entire life in prison with no chance of getting out?
I mean, I would also just say that this is where the issue of elderly prisoners come in. I think a lot of the people we speak about specifically or speak to specifically who were on death row and then their sentence was moved to life in prison without the possibility of parole. They're aging in prison. Elderly prisoners are also the least likely age group to reoffend. They're also the age group that it is most expensive to continue to incarcerate. So you kind of have this these policy issues and then the very real reality of what it costs to keep elderly prisoners detained and the really big burden that that places on the system at the same time as they're the least likely to reoffend. So that's some of the contradiction that we're hoping to address through this film.
In making this film, you were able to speak with people who would be potentially able to get early release. Would you be able to just touch on some of the stories that you heard and if there was one that really stood out to you?
So one of the prisoners that I do think is a really good example of why parole would be important is named Janet Jackson. She has been incarcerated for over three decades for the murder of her husband. So Janet Jackson didn't actually physically murder her husband, but she contracted someone to kill him. And so because of that, she was held responsible for his death and is in prison for life. So she is someone who was abused by her husband. She's spoken a lot about being a survivor of domestic violence and the few tools that she had had for getting out of that relationship or dealing with the trauma of that in any other way. But she talks about how she found some of that while incarcerated. But, you know, today she still faces life in prison. She has a series of health ailments. And at the same time, a lot of the rehabilitative services that she feels helped her get to this place where she was able to move past being a survivor of abuse are no longer available in the prison system because of cost. So I think she's an example of someone who actually has a really complicated story for why they were incarcerated. And I think in a lot of ways is sort of a model for what rehabilitation can look like. And she feels that she would be able to do a lot more good, not behind bars.
For people that do come out and view your film, what do you hope that they take away from it?
I think I would just say that we have tried really hard to bring in kind of as wide of a range of voices as possible into this project. So we obviously talk to the people most affected by this themselves, incarcerated elderly folks. We talk to activists on the ground, but we also talk to people working with the state's attorney's office. We talk to victims groups and people who have themselves been kind of seen tragedy because of violence. And I think that that hopefully lays out kind of a really thorough series of arguments and considerations for what I think is a really complicated and emotional, but really pressing issue.
That's the producer of Stateville Calling, Yana Kunichoff. She's speaking with our Dana Vollmer. Schools in Illinois and across the country are turning to restorative justice practices as an alternative to traditional discipline models. Mikhail Lubansky studies restorative justice, and he's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. While more schools are using restorative justice, Lubansky says there's no guideline or model for what that practice should look like in a school setting. And he spoke with Lee Gaines about the characteristics he says define a successful school-based restorative justice program.
One of them is a willingness of school administrators to themselves engage in restorative practices with their own conflicts and with conflicts between adults in the building. A second thing that I would look for is the participation of youth and families in the creation of the restorative system, the set of agreements about what will we do when we have conflict and we're going to come together to work it out. So rather than something that's dictated by, you know, from the top administrators, restorative justice is intended to be a collaborative process, a community-owned process, and that includes those who are most likely to be impacted by these policies, which are, you know, the young people that are likely to have contact with the discipline system or with the restorative system. Third one is there a sense of voluntariness? So one of the kind of core values is that restorative justice is voluntary. The more voluntary the participation, the more restorative the outcomes. Does everybody have access, and do young people want to make use of this system? And then if we can see that there are some subgroups in a school, let's say students of color, who either almost never activate the system or refuse to participate in the system consistently, then it's feedback to us that there's something in the system that isn't working for that group. And, you know, we'd want to include them and figure out how to tweak it in a way that it will work.
And what is driving the desire from schools, from state lawmakers, et cetera, to make restorative justice a practice of schools?
There's not a lot of debate that the conventional ways of doing discipline in the schools isn't working in the way that we want it to. We now know that the single suspension in year one of high school essentially doubles the risk of dropping out of high school, and dropping out of high school triples the risk of incarceration at a future time. So in some ways, probably the worst thing that we can do with young people is to remove them from the building through suspension. Certainly incarceration is associated with, you know, pretty much all the outcomes we don't want. So I think there's an increasing awareness that we need alternatives. And the two alternatives that have been proposed and have gotten the most support are various types of social-emotional learning programs and restorative justice.
And so you've written about some of the criticisms of the use of restorative justice in schools, which is that it takes too much time, it's emotionally draining, it puts too much of a burden on the victims of harm. So another big criticism that I've heard about is that the practice lacks accountability. Can you explain the difference between accountability and punishment?
So school discipline is modeled on the criminal justice model. You know, who broke the rule? What's the right punishment? And so that's accountability. Accountability in a conventional justice system is equated with punishment. That is the accountability. In restorative justice, we focus not on the punishment, but on understanding and on the agreements to make things right. So the accountability comes from having to face and listen to the people that were harmed and understand the impact of your actions on other people, and to collaborate with them to figure out how to repair the harm. For some people, that sounds soft. When I work with some of the young people in the local juvenile detention center, when I talk to them about restorative justice, most of them aren't interested. You know, the idea of kind of sitting down and having that kind of dialogue is not necessarily appealing. So the accountability comes from understanding impact and having to confront how to make things better.
That's Mikhail Lubansky, a U of I psychology professor, speaking with Lee Gaines, talking about restorative justice. Well, in recent weeks on this show, we've discussed the teacher shortage in the state. Illinois lawmakers are considering a variety of bills that would change the requirements to earn a teaching certificate. And our education reporter, Dusty Rhodes, walks us through a few of the proposals.
Right now, to become a licensed teacher in Illinois, you have to pass at least three tests. The first one is called basic skills. You have to pass that one before your college will even allow you to take education courses. Later, there's a content test for your chosen subject area. And finally, there's a test called the EdTPA, which involves making a video during your one semester of student teaching. Critics point to these requirements as one of the big reasons that 85% of Illinois superintendents say they have a teacher shortage, and that shortage is compounded by a lack of diversity. Illinois teachers are overwhelmingly white, while most students are not.
We have a committee of our African American students that we meet with, and one of the biggest issues that we face is, why doesn't Bradley Bourbonnais and other schools have teachers who look like me? We have zero African-American teachers.
That's Scott Wakely, superintendent of a high school district just north of Kankakee. He came to Springfield last week to tell lawmakers that people who are good at taking tests don't necessarily make the best teachers.
This is my 29th year in education and 16th as a superintendent. I've never released a teacher for lack of knowledge of basic skills. It's always been, can't play nice in the sandbox. Whether it's with the kids, whether it's with fellow teachers, whether it's with parents.
So let's look at the so-called basic skills test. You can use any one of three standardized tests. One, called the TAP, is being phased out in June. That leaves the ACT with a required minimum score of 22 or the SAT with a minimum score of 1110. Failure to hit these cut scores has kept countless candidates out of the teacher pipeline.
We have a minority female college student who wanted to teach Spanish. She was fluent in Spanish, but couldn't pass the math portion of the basic skills test despite many costly attempts. Heartbroken, she chose a new career path. She would have been an exceptional Spanish teacher.
That was Kyle Thompson testifying last week. He's assistant regional superintendent of a 7-county area in east central Illinois. At the University of Illinois Chicago, Catherine Main helps current preschool teachers earn state licenses. Her students all have a GPA of at least 3.0 and an average of 14 years teaching experience. One-third already hold a master's degree. And yet,
what they have facing in front of them is this barrier right now of this basic skills test. And guess what? When I went out and I pounded the pavement to get a bunch of private dollars, and I said, hey, I want to give them what all the rich kids get, which is some high-end tutoring. They came to UIC every single Saturday last semester, and they practiced solving 10th grade math problems as fast as they possibly could. And you know what? Their ACT scores did jump 3-4 points. But for some of them, it's still not enough.
As bad as it sounds, to eliminate a standard that's been titled basic skills, a bill to nix this barrier already has bipartisan support. Some state officials are fighting to hang on to content area tests and that video test for student teachers. Supporters say, hey, at least it shows your ability to stand in front of a class and deliver a lesson. But critics like Wakely say there simply isn't a test to measure the qualities that really count.
Yeah, on a videotape, they can do the dog and pony show. But until it gets real and you have to make relationships with the students because they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I know it's a cliche, but cliches start that way because they're probably true.
One thing all stakeholders agree upon is that testing is only partly to blame for the teacher shortage. Teacher salaries, pensions, and working conditions are also being debated at the Capitol. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Coming up next, a new look at the old story of baseball players throwing the World Series. More on what we now know about the Black Sox. That's ahead on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and this is Statewide.
When a bat meets that ball, and you can just feel that ball just give, and you know it's going to go a long way. Damn, if you don't feel like you're going to live forever. You couldn't give that up. Not for nothing.
That's John Cusack as Buck Weaver in the movie 8 Men Out. That film, based on the book by the same name, details the story of the 1919 World Series. 8 members of the Chicago White Sox were banned from baseball after a gambling scheme to throw the series was uncovered. The book and the movie have become the definitive account of that dark chapter in the history of the national pastime, but does the story match reality? Some new research sheds light on what took place and what didn't. I talk with Jacob Pombrinke. He's with the Society for American Baseball Research, also known as SABRE. He's chair of a committee that has spent years uncovering new information about the Black Sox scandal. So, Jacob, this story has been told for so many years, you would think there's nothing left to learn, but you're saying that's not the case.
A lot of people don't realize that the book 8 Men Out, which is how most of us first learned of the Black Sox scandal story, was written back in 1963, and we've learned a lot of new information in the ensuing half century about the 1919 World Series. And a lot of the new information that we've uncovered has changed our knowledge of the Black Sox scandal and its aftermath and the legacy of the fixing of the World Series. And so all of these new pieces to the puzzle have helped provide definitive answers to some old mysteries and debunk some of the old myths. And the Black Sox scandal continues to be a relevant part of the sports world in the 21st century, especially as Major League Baseball begins to open its doors to legalize sports betting 100 years later. So we're still learning more every day about what happened in the 1919 World Series.
Well, the key theme of this story, and certainly it was laid out in 8 Men Out, was that the White Sox of 1919, a great talented team, was on the take, tied in with gamblers, and that was because they were woefully underpaid. You've discovered some new information on that.
Yes, this is kind of the central thesis of 8 Men Out, that the White Sox players were the most talented, but they were paid like the worst players. And that couldn't be further from the truth. We can't climb into the heads of the Black Sox players to know exactly why they threw the World Series. But we have accurate salary information that sheds a little bit of new light on how much they were paid, and we can compare that to other players around the major leagues. And it turns out that the 1919 White Sox were one of the highest paid teams in baseball, and most of their players were paid far better than their peers in the American League. And so we're able to kind of find, you know, more information about, you know, what may have been going through their minds as they were fixing the World Series. And, you know, if the White Sox players did feel resentment at their salaries under the reserve clause system, so did players from every other major league team. And so the scandal was a lot more complex than disgruntled players trying to get back at the big bad boss.
And the reserve clause basically prevented them from negotiating for salaries with other teams. They couldn't be free agents like we see today.
That's correct. You only had one team to negotiate with, and the owner of the team could offer you a contract, and you had to take it or leave it. So the White Sox players were under the control of Charles Comiskey, and salaries were depressed up until the 1970s when the reserve clause was out of effect. But before then, the players did not have a whole lot of leverage in terms of negotiating for salaries.
You mentioned Charles Comiskey. Of course, he was the owner of the White Sox at the time, and also the namesake for Comiskey Park, which was around for many years.
There is a classic scene in Eight Men Out that I recall where Eddie Cicotte, the pitcher, was trying to negotiate, complaining that he should have gotten a bonus, that he was sort of maneuvered out of this bonus that he should have received from Charles Comiskey, and Comiskey plays hardball with him and refuses to give it.
How many games Mr. Cicotte win for us this year?
29, sir.
You had Kid bench me for 2 whole weeks in August. I missed 5 starts.
We had to rest your arm for the series.
I would have won at least 2 of those games. You knew that.
I have to keep the best interests of the club in mind, Eddie.
I think you owe me that bonus.
29 is not 30, Eddie.
So this kind of dramatic scene in Eight Men Out when Eddie Cicotte tries to collect a $10,000 bonus that he says was promised to him for winning 30 games, that story is completely fictional. No bonus was promised, and certainly not one that would have doubled the pitcher's salary in 1919. Charles Comiskey did promise a few other bonuses, but they were much smaller, around $500 to some of his players. And so the idea that he would have promised a bonus as large as $10,000 to any of his players is pretty ridiculous. And also, you know, we've dug into the box scores and the game information for Eddie Cicotte, and it turns out that he did have a chance to win his 30th game in 1919. He just didn't pitch well enough. He got yanked in a game in late September after allowing 5 runs in 7 innings, and the White Sox rallied to clinch the pennant that year. And that would have been Eddie Cicotte's 30th win. So by then, the fix was already in motion, and Eddie Cicotte had already agreed to join the fix. So the idea that this was the reason that he joined the fix is totally false, and we can back that up.
We hear people talk about how dare they gamble away the World Series. How could they have done that? But gambling on baseball at the time was pretty common, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to understand the Black Sox scandal without understanding just how pervasive gambling was in the baseball world in the early 20th century. This was an era when gamblers gathered openly in every major league ballpark and bet on anything involved in the game. Gamblers would bet on the next pitch, strike or a ball. They would bet on what the batter did, whether he would make a hit or an out. This was something that was going on all the time. And so baseball players and gamblers had a lot of opportunities to associate and to make friends with each other and get to know each other and soon to collaborate with each other. Some of them would work together to provide, the ballplayers would provide gamblers with some crucial information that would help them in their betting that day. And so this is kind of how the culture was in baseball. And baseball officials didn't do anything to slow this down. In fact, they implicitly encouraged the betting activity in the grandstands because, you know, as long as the gamblers were paying money to buy a ticket to get into the ballpark, they didn't really care how much betting was going on during the game. And so there were a lot of attempts at corruption and game fixing in the early 20th century before the 1919 World Series. The idea that the 1919 World Series was this loss of innocence for baseball really, you know, doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
I'm talking with Jacob Pomerinke. He is with SABR, which is the Society for American Baseball Research. He's the director of editorial content for the organization. He also chairs SABR's Black Sox Scandal Research Committee, which is out with some new information. Jacob, why don't you tell us about some of the other research that's been uncovered, what you've actually called in an article, 8 myths out about the Black Sox.
Yes, so SABR just published an online project in which we're debunking some of the common misconceptions about the Black Sox scandal 100 years after the 1919 World Series. This is a story that continues to fascinate baseball fans a century later, and we're able to find a lot of new information. We've got some documents available at the Chicago History Museum, at the National Baseball Hall of Fame, in which we're able to piece together a little bit more of the story than Elliot Asenoff had access to when he wrote 8 Men Out back in 1963. And so we're able to find more information and put together more pieces of the puzzle that way. And one of the interesting myths that we found in digging up the Black Sox scandal story is on the alleged assassin who was hired by one of the gamblers to threaten the White Sox pitcher Lefty Williams before the final game of the 1919 World Series. And the we know now that this hitman character, who was called Harry F. in the book 8 Men Out, out that this hitman was entirely fictional. He was created from the imagination of the author, Elliot Asanoff, for copyright reasons. And there's little evidence that Lefty Williams was ever threatened, but this is one of the most dramatic scenes in the movie Eight Men Out and in the book. But we know now, and Elliot Asanoff admitted later in life, that he had invented this fictional character. So this is one of many of the misconceptions about how the Black Sox scandal occurred and what really happened in 1919.
One of the other things that I think has always been taken as fact is that the players went sort of underground after this occurred. You didn't hear from them much. They just faded from public view because they were ashamed of what had occurred. That also isn't entirely accurate.
No, it's not. And, you know, when Elliot Asanoff went to interview some of the surviving Black Sox players when he was researching the book, what became the book Eight Men Out, he encountered a lot of resistance from the ball players. They didn't really want to talk to him. Happy Felch was his main source among the players as far as the Black Sox who would be interviewed by him for the book. But none of the other players who were alive would talk to him much. And Asanoff attributed their reluctance to talk to kind of the shame that they all felt about the 1919 World Series. This was a subject that he said nobody really wanted to talk about. And that actually wasn't true. And we've discovered, thanks to the power of the internet, more than 100 interviews among participants in the 1919 World Series, both the White Sox and the Reds players. And so it shows that a lot of people were willing to talk about this, the World Series. Those interviews just weren't very easy for Elliot Asanoff to find in 1963. Thanks to the power of the internet, we're able to dig up a lot of these small town newspapers, which have been digitized and are available for researchers online. And so we've been able to find a lot of information from the players that they did talk to people. And this wasn't something where they hung their heads in shame about the World Series. This was just something that happened. And, you know, some of them regretted and had some remorse for what they had done. And they just kind of moved on with their lives.
Buck Weaver was one of those that was kicked out of the game, one of the Eight Men Out, among those that have seen a lot of support through the years, long after his death, those who feel he was wrongly lumped in with the others. Shoeless Joe Jackson has become almost mythic in books and movies. Many think he was given a raw deal with his banishment from baseball. Has your research turned up anything to help or hurt those causes?
You know, Buck Weaver and Shoeless Joe Jackson have a lot of support and a lot of sympathy, because the truth about the Black Sox scandal is there were a lot of different degrees of guilt among the people involved. And Buck Weaver, for sure, had a much lesser degree of guilt than, say, his teammates Eddie Seacott and Chick Gandel, two of the instigators of the fix. Buck Weaver did not take any money, any bribes from gamblers, and by all accounts, he played his best during the World Series on the field. So a lot of people have sympathy for Buck Weaver and say that a lifetime banishment was a very harsh punishment for someone with his degree of guilt. You know, we haven't really turned up a lot of information that can confirm or deny his involvement. We have known all along that he attended some of the meetings discussing the fix before the World Series, and by some accounts, he was an active participant in those discussions. But nobody said that he ever took any money from gamblers or played anything less than his best. So he has a lot of support among fans and his surviving family members to try to get his name cleared. And, you know, the punishment among the players was pretty harsh. And Judge Landis came in as the baseball commissioner and in one fell swoop banned them all for life from playing professional baseball again. And you could argue that, you know, this was a little bit of an unjust punishment, because, you know, players today would have a lot more recourse to appeal that punishment. The players' union is strong, and they would have some legal remedies available to them that they did not have available to them in 1919. So you can argue that the punishment was harsh based on the degrees of their guilt. What you can't argue is that the punishment to ban these players for life was ineffective, because baseball had many problems with gambling and game fixing before the 1919 World Series. And after Judge Landis banned the Black Sox, these problems almost entirely went away. And so the idea was for Judge Landis to come in and clean up baseball. And he was able to do so. And that was largely through his punishment of the Black Sox. You know, if he could punish someone like Buck Weaver, who no one admitted ever took a bribe or played anything less than his best on the field, if he could punish Buck Weaver for life, then he could punish anyone for associating with gamblers. And so he was able to clean up baseball through his punishment of the Black Sox, and especially with Buck Weaver.
What do you hope that people take away from this new research?
Well, you know, I hope people understand that the story is a lot more complex than sometimes we find in books and on film. I think the you know, like many areas of history, there's a lot of compelling aspects, and the truth is just as dramatic as some of the fictional elements that we've all grown up believing. And you know, again, this is a story that continues to have relevance in 2019. You know, as sports betting becomes more and more legalized and more pervasive around the game, you know, there are a lot of lessons that baseball and sports fans can learn from the Black Sox scandal. And as we learn more about what happened back in 1919, you know, we can apply some of those lessons to 2019 too.
Jacob Pomrinke helped author an online project on the 1919 Black Sox scandal titled Eight Myths Out. A symposium featuring the research will be held at the Chicago History Museum in September. You can find links to the latest research available at statewideshow.com. That's all for this week on Statewide. Thanks for joining us. If you missed any of this episode or past episodes, go to our website, statewideshow.com. You can also find our email there and drop us a line. And be with us next time as we bring you more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.